Excuse me. Love and marriage, they go together like a horse and a carriage. I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Well, that's what the chairman of the board, Frank Sinatra, said or saying. And you know, when Frank Sinatra speaks, that settles it, right? But does it? Love and marriage. What about sex and marriage? I mean, why didn't Old Blue Eyes sing about that? Sex and marriage, you can't have one without the other. And yet the reality is some people would say, oh yeah, you can. People do it every day. Well, that's true. What about marriage without sex? Some people do that. In fact, a lot of married people do that. What about no sex and no marriage? Can you imagine Frank singing about that? Old Blue Eyes didn't have to deal with all that stuff. He just kept it simple. He kept it safe. Love and marriage. But the problem is, marriage just isn't about love. I mean, people get married to the opposite sex because they're sexually attracted to them. And so sex is a big part of marriage. I mean, think about it. If sex wasn't within marriage, then what we would be looking for is companionship and a good friend, and you could do that with the same gender. Sex becomes a big part of marriage, just as much as love does. And sex is an expression of love, and yet sexual attraction is what leads us to the one we love. The Apostle Paul, in our study of 1 Corinthians, deals with the issue of sex and of marriage. Now, this is interesting. As we go into this chapter, chapter 7, it's a transitional chapter. Because in the first six chapters, Paul is responding to things that he's heard about with the Corinthians. Things that weren't good. Spiritual pride, sexual immorality, believers taking believers to court. And he writes to them with a certain disdain. And he writes to them in order for them to get their acts together. But in chapter 7 and on, he no longer talks about what he's heard about and what he's upset about. He writes to them to answer their questions that they have. And one of the big questions on their mind was the issue about sex and marriage. The issue about celibacy and marriage. You see, there were some in that day who were beginning to teach that if you wanted to really be spiritual, it meant to stop being sexual. That if you really wanted to know the heart and mind of God, if you wanted God to really minister within you, then you need to go it alone. And so they write to Paul and they ask the question, is celibacy superior to marriage? And so Paul takes the issue up in chapter 7. In the Roman world, sex and marriage, well, you can say both of them ran rampant. The average Roman, well, I shouldn't say the average, but it was not unusual for Roman citizens to have up to, are you ready for this? 20 marriages. 20 marriages. Because marriage was considered something not only lax, but almost laughable. And marriage came in different forms. In fact, there were four different types of marriage within Roman society. One was the kind of marriage that a master would engage with a slave, where he would just decide to marry his slave. The slave didn't have any say over it, and any time the master wanted to break off the union, he could break it off. The second was what we call common law marriage, but in the Roman world, if you lived with somebody for over a year, you were married. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Why would you view them as married just because they're living together? Because we understand that there's something going on in a bond that over time just, it can't be something casual. There has to be something significant. There has to be a giving and taking in life that starts to meld people to being one, whether the Romans recognized it or not. The third was when a father sold his daughter to someone for marriage. In other words, he had the power to do so, and if he needed money, he could find somebody who was willing to purchase his daughter. He would just sell her off to be married. And the last form of marriage is sort of what we celebrate today. In fact, there are Latin words for each one of them, and I won't waste your time on those. But this one particularly, conferrato, was marriage that took place in the upper class. This is where we get our marriage from, because it was a celebration. It was a time where people came together, where it took on a sense of royalty. You know, anytime you see recessions and processions going on in a religious service, that came from Roman royalty. When the church became official in Roman society, when the emperor embraced, when Constantine embraced Christianity, the first thing he did was, in his mind, he cleaned up the church. In other words, he got these pastors who were just people who preached in homes, and he built these huge cathedrals. And he had them dress up in royal garb. That's why when you go into a Catholic church, say a Roman Catholic church, you'll see priests in this royal garb, and they will proceed into a service and recede into a service because it represented what goes on in royalty. Well, that's what happened in marriage. All of a sudden, you had a bride who had a bridesmaid, who had a train of people following her. And you had a groom, and you had a groomsman. It became something official, it became something royal for those in the upper class to celebrate. Now, it's interesting, when you look at all four forms of marriage, other than selling your daughter, we still have those today. But in Paul's day, it was so diverse, and it didn't really seem to matter how you got married or whether you stayed married. And so the Corinthians wrote to Paul saying, what's the deal with this thing? Marriage has become so watered down and has become so sinful. Is it better for a person not to marry? Is it better for them to be celibate in order to be close to God? Now, Paul takes up the issue, and we're going to look at this, and we're not only going to see the answer to this, but what I want you to see is a deeper principle that Paul works off of. I was speaking to someone recently who said to me, you know, I don't really understand how Paul could speak and write on matters that Jesus didn't speak on or write on. In other words, the apostles, they traveled with Jesus. They heard Jesus. And so what they wrote in the Gospels, how could Paul later write stuff that wasn't in the Gospels when Paul didn't travel with Jesus? Well, the reality is, we're told in Galatians, that Paul spent 3 years in the Arabian desert with Jesus. That he was taught by him and not by any man, Paul says. And what we see in that is that he had probably one of the best tutoring, one of the best educations of any man, that Jesus gave to him spiritual principles, just like he did the other apostles, and we see it in Peter's letter and in James's letter, how they apply them. But we see Paul particularly taking those principles and applying them to life situations in order that we might glorify God. And so what I want you to see is this, and I'm going to flesh this out in a minute. Beyond just the issue of whether it's better to marry or not marry is a bigger issue, is an issue that led Paul to the conclusion that he shares us with, and a bigger issue for us as we look at our lives. In fact, as we look at the rest of 1 Corinthians chapter, throughout, we're going to see that Paul uses this principle to answer a number of their questions. So let's look at the issue. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Paul says, "Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman." Now, when you hear that, you can hear people saying, "That's ridiculous. How is that good? It's not good." In fact, for some people, the thought of not having sexual, that's impossible. That's just weird. That's ridiculous. That's not quite what Paul meant when he said it is good for a man not. Listen to Dr. Kevin Weiss, his translation of this, which is better than the NIV. He says, "It is perfectly proper, honorable, morally befitting for a man to live in strict celibacy." In other words, when Paul's saying it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, what he's saying is this. Yes, celibacy is good. Because the question is, should you be celibate or should you be married? Paul isn't saying that marriage isn't good. Paul isn't saying that sexuality is bad. He's just saying that, yeah, celibacy is good just as marriage is good. It is proper. It is right. Now, you got to put yourself in the mindset of the first century, especially the first century Jews who were hearing this kind of stuff preached, because to them it sounded so foreign and it sounded so anti the Hebrew scriptures. Because in Genesis 1, God calls a man and woman to be together, to be helpmates. And he goes on and he calls them to be fruitful and multiply. This was the teaching throughout the Hebrew lifespan, throughout the Old Testament history. And now they're hearing this, what they see as weird preaching, that no, it's okay for a man not to take a wife. It's okay for a man not to engage in procreation. It's okay to be alone and be celibate. And so for the average Jew to hear that, it's not okay. God created you to need a helpmate. And with that helpmate, you are to help repopulate or populate the world. But in Christianity, something different takes place. There's a shift that takes place. Marriage is no longer about procreation or partnership. Marriage is a picture for the church. Marriage is about purity. But it's about the church. Paul says this is allowable because the mission has changed. The mission is not about to populate a nation, the nation of Israel, to be a blessing to the people of Israel because they failed. He says the mission now is salvation for God's people. The mission now is to share the good news of salvation to the world. But you just got to put yourself in the place of the first century. Put yourself in the place of the Jews who are hearing this. Put yourself in the place of believers who are hearing this. It shook their world. Paul goes on as he talks about celibacy, he switches to sexuality within marriage. He says, but since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. Now, if you got notes, if you take notes, you can write these down. Because we're going to get into stuff here that people either abuse, are confused by, or just become angered by these words. So, what is Paul saying about sexuality within marriage? One, he's saying it's exclusive. Notice he says that each man should have sexual relations with his wife and each wife with her husband. Sexuality is exclusive within marriage. When Paul's addressing the issue of whether you should be celibate or not, he's addressing the issue of whether you should be married or not. Sexuality happens within the context of marriage. When people say, well, the Bible doesn't say anything about living together. Oh, yeah, it does. Very clearly. If you're going to be sexual, it's within the context of marriage. If it's acceptable before God. It is something exclusive that goes on between a husband and a wife. And to bring it further clarity to other sexual issues, homosexuality, it is something that goes on between a husband and a wife, period. The mandate that God began in Genesis, in creation, is followed up thousands of years later in the New Testament, even as God makes this shift in marriage and celibacy, he does not make a shift in the sense of what goes on in the created order. Sexuality is exclusive, but look what we read. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. What do you think about that? Because we live in a culture today that says what? A woman's body is her own. And Paul says no. Paul says a woman's body is not her own. A man's body is not his own. Your body belongs to God. And if you're married, your body belongs to your spouse. Why is it that we get jealous in marriage? Because we say, hey, what are you doing talking to that person? Or what's going on? You're mine. I'm yours. We made a covenant. Sexuality within marriage is meant to be exclusive. It's also meant to be submissive. A man submits to his wife, a wife submits to her husband. And when that doesn't happen, you see marriage on the rocks. You see a lot of anger and bitterness and selfishness. Sexuality withheld biblically is sexual infidelity just as much as cheating on your spouse is infidelity. What is infidelity? Infidelity simply means disobedience to God's word, not being faithful to the truth of God's word. Paul says this, you can't withhold. Sexuality is something that when we get married, we understand we're getting married to be exclusive with each other and to be submissive to each other, to love and care. Listen to what Warren Wiersbe writes. Sexual love is a beautiful tool to build with, not a weapon to fight with. To refuse each other is to commit robbery and to invite Satan to tempt the partner to seek their satisfaction elsewhere. Those are pretty strong words. But they begin with sexuality between a man and woman is a beautiful tool to build with. But it can be a destructive tool to tear things down if we don't engage with it with the sense of submissiveness that God has called us to. Paul says, well, let's go on. He says, do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. It's meant to be exclusive. It's meant to be submissive. It's also meant to be sensitive. Sensitive to your partner, and sensitive to God spiritually in what's going on. When in a marriage is it permissible not to be sexual? Well, Paul says, by mutual consent, when both of you agree that there are serious things going on and that you want to come before God in prayer. In fact, we see that in the scriptures, in the Old Testament, over and over again, where people are called by God to enter into fasting and prayer. Where we're called to put off the things of the flesh and to earnestly seek him, and at times to repent and turn away from our own sinful desires. Sexuality is exclusive. It is submissive. It is sensitive. It's sensitive to our partners. Yeah, my body doesn't belong to me. It belongs to my spouse. And my spouse's body doesn't belong to her. It belongs to me. And yet, even within that is the sensitivity of knowing, how is my spouse doing? What's going on in their lives? If they're upset, if something's on their heart or mind, and I don't care for that, but only care for my own needs, then I sin against God, not only sin against my spouse. The whole idea of sexuality is one, to bring God glory, but two, it's to build intimacy. And intimacy is only built when you care about what's going on with the other person and not care about your own personal needs. Exclusive, submissive, sensitive, and lastly, protective. Protective so that you're not tempted away. Protective for your spouse so that you don't make life harder. Now, once again, we're to stand on our own when it comes to our own moral behavior. You know, I was talking to a guy who was struggling with addiction, and he said, my wife tells me, I don't feel like it, and I'm not in the mood, and it makes me so angry, because I'm thinking, here I am trying to deal with this addiction, and you just make it hard because you leave me out there waiting. Well, it might make it hard, but not impossible. The reality is this. What your spouse is doing is wrong, and we'll have to answer to God for that. But whatever's going on in marriage, we still have to stand strong. Yet we protect our spouses by not withholding our sexuality. But even in that, God calls us to protect our spouses as we stand tall before him. No matter what goes on in our marriage, we're responsible for what we do. And yet, what we do with our spouses can be a blessing, it can be protective, or it can be selfish, and it can be destructive. Paul goes on and says this, I say this as a concession and not a command. And what he means by that is, the concession is this. He's saying, I'm not saying that being married is wrong. I'm just saying that it's okay to be celibate. It's okay to be single. It's okay to dedicate yourself to Christ, just like it is okay to dedicate yourself to Christ within marriage. I wish that all of you were as I am. But each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Paul is very practical. If you're a person who's going to burn with passion, then don't say, I'm going to live a life of celibacy, because that ain't going to work. I know people who have committed themselves to celibacy, earnest people who love God, and they are successful in it because it was the gift that God had given them. They did not feel called to marriage. They felt called to something beyond marriage for them because they understood it was sacrificial. But if you're not called, then you don't try to wear a call that isn't yours. Okay. So what's the principle in all this? The spiritual is to always govern the physical. Now, that seems simple, but it's not simple. It's not simple for the spiritual to govern the physical. It's hard. When you hear this stuff, I know, whenever I write my messages, I always think, what are they thinking? And if I was a woman, I'd be thinking, yeah, right. I don't think so. I'll handle this. I've been handling it well all these years. Because if my body belongs to him, I won't have a body anymore. I get it. For the spiritual to direct the physical, that's tough stuff. Look, to be celibate, to be single and not want to be single and know that I want to be married because I'm sexual and this is what I want. This is part of what I want. I want love and companionship, but I want intimacy. I want sensuality. But Paul would also say the spiritual's got to govern the physical because it doesn't turn out well if it doesn't. In fact, in marriage, when the spiritual governs the physical, something wonderful takes place. The spiritual makes the physical sacramental. The spiritual makes the physical sacramental. God takes something physical and he makes it a spiritual blessing that not only draws us nearer to our spouse, but draws us nearer to him. Now go back to that other slide. The spiritual is always to govern the physical in order to be beneficial. You want the best benefit from anything physical? Then the spiritual has to drive it. That's the principle. Paul looks at the issue of celibacy and marriage, and he simply says this: let the spiritual drive the physical. Now, apply that any way you want to other areas of life, knowing you don't like to be told what to do. So when God calls you with your money to be generous, we don't like to be told what to do with our money. And yet, interesting enough, we'll all say that we're generous people. But on our terms and when we want to. Not when God tells us we have to. We all think that we're loving, caring people until the Bible tells us we have to do something we don't want to do. Like forgive our neighbors. Or give of our time. You see, there are all sorts of things in the scriptures that God calls us to do that goes right against the grain of who we are. Turn the other cheek. I don't like that one, frankly. Oh, Joe, stop laughing. See, I always try to translate it, turn the other cheek. I guess that means theirs. No, it doesn't. But you can translate it any way you want. But if you translate it the way God wants, when the spiritual governs the physical, great things happen. God transforms us. When the spiritual doesn't govern the physical, you know what we end up with? Immaturity. Think about it. When you think about immaturity, what do you think about? People not acting their age. People acting like children. What do we hear from children all the time? I, me, that's mine. No, I'm not giving it, you know. But when adults act like that, instead of doing the right thing, we just want to do what feels good, and we go off the rails. Paul says the physical has to govern the spiritual in order for the physical to become beneficial. You want to enjoy your money? Then let the spiritual determine the physical. You want to enjoy your money? Then let God direct where it goes. And God is generous. God will not only not deprive you, but God will bless you. God will overwhelm you. God will let you have good things, but let them come from Him. I firmly believe the more you give, the more you get. I just believe that. Why? Because when the spiritual governs the physical, God does something supernatural. When it comes to your temper, when the spiritual governs the physical, we move to maturity and away from immaturity. I don't care what you apply it to. See, what weighs in balance is spiritual maturity or spiritual immaturity? What weighs in balance is whether you're going to experience what is beneficial or what is destructive. Just think about it. When God says a man's body doesn't belong to him, but it belongs to his wife and vice versa, and you're to give each other, what does that build? It builds a sense of being sacramental, a sacrificial, which God will make sacramental. It builds intimacy within a relationship. It is an expression of love. It is showing the other person that their needs matter and they're not to be timed on my personal desires or whims or how I feel about them. When the spiritual governs the physical, it becomes beneficial. Now let me say this. Are there times to withhold? Yeah, that's when the physical becomes something ugly and depraved. But that's not what Paul's talking about. Paul's talking about a normal situation in life between a man and a woman. He's talking about the principle of what will drive it. And you can apply it to any area of life. And what's at stake is this, maturity or immaturity. And what's at stake with that is God's glory. Why do you do what you do? Why are we here? We are here to glorify God. How do we do it? With our hearts, with our minds, with our bodies. With all that we have and all that we are. And if we do that, God will take all of it. He will take all of the physical, and he will turn it out and make it beneficial for your lives. Let's join our hearts together in prayer.